and counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Rachel Young, counsel for the petitioner Keith Bender. This court should reverse the decision of the United States District Court primarily for three reasons. First, this court should determine that the amended complaint in this matter meets the particularity requirements of Rule 9B of the Rules of Civil Procedure. Secondly, this court should find that in the alternative, because the plaintiff in this matter has a lack of access to the specific documents that are exclusively within the possession and control of the contractors in this matter, that he has met the standard of this court under its Williams decision that allow him to plead based on information and belief the facts upon which he relies. Third,
you still have to have a pleading of the facts, albeit on information and belief. And it's a bit hard to look at your complaint here and determine what person did what when. It's not quite just coming in and saying they did some fraudulent, this company did some fraud, somebody with this company did some fraudulent things during a time span, but is it really much more than that you said here?
Yes, Your Honor. We would certainly concede that the Mr. Bender's prior counsel's amended complaint is not artfully drafted. However, we would request that this court not hold that against the specific party, and what we would certainly assert is, upon conducting a very detailed analysis and looking at the specific allegations alleged under each count, the basics of who, what, when, why, and how are actually there. And if you like, I can go into detail count by count of how that occurs.
Why don't you do that for counts? Do it first for counts 1 and 2, and then let's talk separately about the other counts.
Sure. Count 1, Your Honor, deals with the falsification of service repairs. And certainly under this specific count, what he has alleged here is a scheme by the contractors to essentially, using both employees whom were subordinates of management and then the managers themselves recording false service completion times
now
to the government.
In giving us 9B specificity, you really haven't done much more yet than the complaint does.
Sure.
Can you tell me what paragraphs
yes,
and from
I
whence
can.
You would draw the 9B specificity on?
Yes, Your Honors. Specifically, if you would turn to paragraph 53 of the amended complaint, it identifies, and what I'm getting at specifically right now is the who was involved. Paragraph 53 identifies the back end, the 10 people identified by name who were involved on the back end being directed by management to falsify the allegations. And then simply...
And all that paragraph says it is that some entry of false response in computer times was done by some bunch of people.
Correct.
It doesn't give us a single specific instance of a single specific person falsifying a single specific document on a single specific day.
Sure. Well, I think what the amended claim does, Your Honor, it identifies who was involved on the back end, and again, that's general. But it also identifies the two specific people who were involved in making the submission of those records to the government, whom under count one were Carothers and Roost, and that's identified, I believe, under either paragraphs 49 or 56. And the complaint goes on to actually identify a specific situation, which is under paragraph number 71, wherein the appellant, Mr. Bender, observed personally someone specifically doing it, and it was the relative of the assistant project manager, and he describes how he confronted that person about, as well as the project manager, about that specific allegation. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I take it your point is that, as you argue the case, that I take it the only thing in your mind that's missing is a specific claim on a specific date documents which your client would not have had access to. Is that your point?
It is, Your Honor. Ideally, we would love to be able to assert on January 1st this occurred with this document. And in fact, I mean, that's done for, I believe, some of the items under count 3 or 4. However, that is the specific information that is missing.
We have a general problem with that argument. Is QTAM is an extraordinary statute, and it does contemplate a level of specificity in pleading that seems to suggest that if you don't have that knowledge, you shouldn't be bringing a QTAM. And what you seem to be arguing is we should be able to bring a QTAM and then get that knowledge. Isn't that inconsistent with the statutory
scheme? Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. What we have here is a situation, and the court has looked at this issue before in its decision in Williams, where it has acknowledged that one of the things that is particular to False Claims Act claims is the fact that the person bringing the claim, if it's not the government, is usually a former employee. And in Williams, the court specifically acknowledged, and I believe I have a quote of it here, which was that, you know, this circuit has essentially recognized that, and it has provided an avenue for plaintiffs who are unable to meet the particularity standard because the defendants control the relevant documents. So this circuit has previously acknowledged this very problem for people like my client, whom is no longer employed by these contractors, and as such has no access. And I'd go further to say that even while employed, in the capacity that he worked, he was an electrician or essentially a laborer, performing the day-in, day-out routine requirements. And as such, he observed and he related with his, you know, fellow colleagues the fraudulent activities that they saw occurring. And he has been able, throughout the amended complaint, to essentially aver and to plead based on the information of and belief, not only the things that he's observed, but things that others have related to him. So it is our belief that, you know, certainly we acknowledge that we're not able to identify for every specific count each and every instance wherein the fraud occurred, and that those documents and that information is in this exclusive possession currently of the contractors. But we would direct this court's attention to two decisions, one of which was by Judge Kessler, and it was issued, I believe, in the Head decision approximately 6 months after she dismissed this matter, as well as the district court's decision in the case of Bucci, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, wherein the court stated essentially that at this early stage of litigation, a False Claims Act plaintiff need not allege with specificity every element of its cause of action if the complaint contains allegations from which an inference may be drawn that the plaintiff will produce evidence on the essential elements. So going back to doing the analysis count by count, we believe that there is significant information about who, what, where, why, and how, explaining the alleged schemes. And if he is given an opportunity to proceed to discovery, we can close up those missing details about the specific date now, and the nature of the submission.
Now, even if you're right about counts 1 and 2, 3, 4, and 5 are dramatically different, aren't they? I mean, they're extremely general, and actually, you know, I don't even see in them any allegations of fraud at all. I mean, they look like breach of contract claims. I don't see anything there. I mean, there's none of the specificity of counts 1 and 2, and as I said, they look like breach of contracts, right? There's no specific claims identified, right? And there's no allegation of any misrepresentation to the government.
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for that point. I'd like to address specifically the issue of breach of contract versus false claims. And, you know, they're somewhat similar, but the distinction, of course, here is, obviously my client has, as a relator, has no standing to bring a breach of contract claim. So the distinction has to be the submission of a false claim to the government.
Yes, but you have to allege that. And there is no allegation here about that. There's no allegation here at all that the government's payments under these contracts were somehow dependent on a, say, certification by the companies. Take, for example, count three, which is, you know, the argument here is they billed the government for work done by unlicensed employees, right? That's count three.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so where is the allegation that, you know, that the company certified to the government that these people were, in fact, licensed? In other words, falsely certified something to the government that was a material condition of payment?
Yes, Your Honor.
You agree you would have to have that, correct?
We certainly agree. I mean, that's the predicate of a false claims
claim. Right, so
claim.
Where is it?
Again, we're winding to when we indicated that it's not artfully pled.
But don't go through that again.
Artful, I'm not sure artful is the right word for counts 3, 4, and 5. I get you. I understand your point about 1 and 2. But the defects in 3, 4, and 5 seem to be slightly higher than in artful. I just don't see the allegations there.
Sure. Let me address first count three, Your Honor. What count three essentially does, and the district court did find that it didn't believe that there was an actual claim, a false claim submitted concerning the licensing. But this court and the circuit has acknowledged the theory.
No, look at your complaint and tell us where you allege a false representation, material false representation.
I believe, Your Honor, and I can't identify the specific paragraph. I can grab the specific complaint, but the argument would be, in essence, that under an implied false certification theory, which is a legal theory that identifies what is essentially false, the test that was adopted and set forth by this circuit in this SAIC decision indicates that if a contractor has withheld information about its noncompliance, which is the allegation in count three, that the contractors withheld specific information indicating that these electricians providing the service were not licensed. And if that withholding of the noncompliance information is a material contract requirement, that he can establish the false certification.
Right, but none of that's in this complaint. That's the
point. Turning back to the complaint, I believe that the allegations in the complaint are there. Specifically, he has identified the allegations in the complaint of what the contract entails. And then he goes on to identify.
You have the contract, right? You quote from the contract.
We have the contract.
So is there anything in the contract that says that the government won't pay if these people aren't properly licensed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but we would also
state. That's the problem with your case.
But the court's decision, this court's decision in SAIC, essentially held that an express statement is not necessary to satisfy the materiality element.
We hold that in SAIC?
That is my understanding and my reading of the case,
but if,
that it
but,
expressly
but
held
implied,
that.
As I understand it, isn't it true that for the implied theory to work, the company, the contractor itself has to represent in a request for payment that the employees in this case were not licensed?
Sure, and that's again where the argument for the implied false certification comes into play, Your Honor. And specifically, what the allegations in the complaint essentially show, facts from which it is possible to allege and to infer that if the government had known about this significant aspect of the contract that was not being conformed with, it was reasonable for it not to pay.
The only citation I find in your brief to our decision in SAIC is in footnote 1 on page 18, and it refers to us expressly not deciding a different issue than this one.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I'm referring to the reply brief, where it's addressed in fuller detail.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sure. So what we would allege, Your Honors, under this standard here is that in a situation where we're involving small businesses, wherein the contractors supervise unlicensed people, and with respect to the contractor, NATI, we've alleged that 1 out of 5 electricians were certified, which means 80% were not. And certainly, given the role and the responsibilities of these particular individuals in performing services under the USDA's complex, and the safety issues and liability issues that are concerned, we think it is possible to infer from the statements in the amended complaint that, for one, the managers knew these people were not licensed. The subcontractor, PAE, and CTSI, when they became involved, picked up two of these unlicensed people. And given that the managers, we're not dealing with a level or a chain of command that these people are far removed. They were directly supervised by the very same managers whom you can safely infer were aware of the requirement in the contract. And based on that, we can safely say that given the importance of the duties, given the close relationship that these people had with the unlicensed workers, that it's reasonable to infer that they knew that unlicensed people were working under a contract that required them to be licensed.
I don't want to be terribly picky, but when you say U.S., say SAS, you're talking about United States versus Science Applications International Corporation, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Science Applications, I think it's International Corporation.
And how does it make this complaint into a good complaint as to count 3, 4, and 5?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding of the decision in SAIC is that the rule of the circuit is that Mr. Bender does not need to show that the contractors violated a provision of the contract that expressly conditioned payment on this specific requirement, but that it is sufficient to look at the materiality and to look at whether the facts can be inferred that rise to the level of determining, at least at this early stage in the proceedings, that burden has been established. While SAIC provides, I think, the test, it is different in the sense that it deals with the jury verdict, which means that they've already gone through this process, the discovery process, and the trial. We would like to direct this court's attention to the court's decision, I believe, in Harris, which is a district court decision, and as well as Honeywell.
Wait a minute. Whoa. You just said this court's decision in Harris, which is a district court decision.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's get one or the other,
it's
please.
The nerves. The Harris decision and the Honeywell decision, which I just mentioned, those are district court decisions and are cited, I believe, in our reply brief. And again, you know, specifically Honeywell, I think, really stands for the proposition that if you allege facts that, of course, at this stage are taken as true, they create a strong inference that the government would not have paid, we believe, under the facts alleged under count 3, that had the government known, for instance, that 80% of these electricians weren't licensed and were performing work that presented a safety hazard and a liability hazard, all sorts of hazards dealing with electronics and wiring, et cetera, that it would not have paid those claims. Likewise, just to go back and address count 4 very quickly, if I may, as Judge Tate
said. Your time's been up, but we'll give you about 2 more minutes and then you'll be through, unless
sure.
My colleagues have questions. Go ahead.
I'll just go back and address your question regarding count 4, Your Honor, which dealt with the fraudulent billing and the overtime. The court, again, obviously, the district court dismissed these claims because it didn't see a false allegation.
Right.
And again, looking very carefully at the allegations, what stands out to me is the allegation that under the contract, core work generally needed to be done during core hours, but there were specific instances where work could not be performed during regular business hours due to the interruption it would cause to the government. And the contract provided that those certain types of work to exclude it from regular hours must be performed by the contractor after hours, shifting the time, the shift times of its employees to perform that work at no extra charge to the government. And the allegation in this count 4, is that the contractors essentially alleged claims for overtime based on the work that was specifically prevented from being charged for under the specific provisions of the contract.
Okay.
So
I think we probably have gone far enough over your time now. So
sure.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Hear from the appellee. I'm sorry, the get my order here straight. Hear from the amicus United States first. Excuse me, counsel, we don't usually let amicus talk, so we're...
Thank you, Your Honor.
About to miss you there.
Thank you, Your Honor. Benjamin Schultz on behalf of the United States. The government has participated in as amicus in this case because the district court incorrectly construed a provision in FARA's FARA that governs the retroactive application of that statute. And in particular, the district court incorrectly construed the word claim in FARA's section 4F1 to be a defendant's request for payment rather than a plaintiff's legal claim. And in doing so, the district court relied on erroneous district court decisions.
Now, that's the only proposition you address in this case, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're taking no position on whether the district court reached the right result here with respect to the 9B specificity.
That's correct, Your Honor. We take no position on
this. You're taking no position as to whether the claims counts 3, 4, and 5 survive a claim for relief.
That's correct, Your Honor. We take no position.
In fact, isn't it true that the issue you're concerned about is only implicated with respect to the subcontractor?
Presumably, it would only be implicated
if the subcontractor is out for other reasons, it's not an issue we have to address at all.
We take no position on that, but generally speaking,
it's only implicated by that, the charges against the subcontractor.
Typically, the Allison engine issue would be an issue that would arise when you have a third party like a subcontractor.
In this case, the subcontractor is what triggers it.
And if the subcontractor is dismissed for other reasons, then your issue, the one the government's concerned about, isn't something we have to deal with, right?
Your Honor, that's not something that we take a position on, but generally speaking, that issue would only arise with a third party, like a subcontractor.
Okay.
I'd be happy to address the court's questions if there are any on the substance.
I have further questions. We'll hear from the appellee.
I don't have any.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Tax money at work.
Good morning. I'm David Fierst. I represent all of the defendants other than PAE. Mary Lou Suller represents PAE. I'll be giving the argument for all parties. Rule 9B tells us what needs to be alleged, and the Twombly and Iqbal cases tell us how they need to be alleged. What needs to be alleged are the specifics. You've gone over them already this morning. I don't need to repeat them. It's the who, what, where, when. The important part, I think, is Twombly and Iqbal, which tell us how they have to be alleged. They have to be alleged through allegations of fact, not merely conclusions. Inferences are permissible if they are based upon facts that are alleged in the complaint. It's not enough merely to repeat buzzwords from the statute. Throughout the complaint, we read that someone knew, should have known, deliberately, was ignorant, recklessly indifferent. These are just words from the statute. It's not enough. There has to be a fact alleged. And the allegations have to be plausible. Now, plausible in this context, as identified in Twombly, means enough facts have to be alleged that if those facts are presumed true or found true by a jury or the court, that in itself is sufficient to support a complaint. Here, as we will see, going through this count by count, all we have are broad conclusory statements. We don't have allegations of fact. We don't have enough.
You can probably tell from more questions. I mean, you seem to be completely right about that with respect to counts 3, 4, 5. But counts 1 and 2 look quite different. They describe the scheme in detail. They give you the period of time. They specifically charge falsification of completion times. They list the names of quite a few individuals who were involved. They give an eyewitness example. They talk about how much of the fraud. So, it's pretty specific. I get your point about 3, 4, and 5, but 1 and 2 are very specific.
Actually, with all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree with that. On count 1, for example, no specific times are given.
They gave a range. They gave the period of time.
The period of time we're given is an 11-year range.
Right.
There's no court that has held that that's sufficient under 9B or under the False Claims Act.
But this is a situation where, but the allegation here is that this is a continuing problem. It happens virtually every month when these bills are submitted, that these items are falsified, that the dates are falsified every month, and the claims are made every month. So, and you have the period of time. So it's hard, to see what else
Sorry, Your Honor.
That's all, yeah.
What's missing here are, for example, in your question you said, it says that the items are falsified. Well, that's really the first question. What items are falsified? All we have are a broad conclusory allegation that some work wasn't done on time.
No. The allegation is that the company had a practice in order to increase their bonuses of inserting fraudulent completion dates. That's the scheme. He identifies people who did it. He saw one himself. I mean, these are specific allegations. True, they could be more specific if he had more documents.
Well, no,
but he's given you, this is clearly not an Iqbal problem, and it's hard for me to see why it's a 9B problem. The only thing he doesn't have, as I can tell here, is actual submissions of the specific claims. But, you know, that he's claimed, look, he's a low-level electrician. He's not likely to have that. In fact, that's the only thing that's missing, as far as I can tell, is what he is unlikely to have, namely those particular documents.
Well, he alleges a scheme, Your Honor. The scheme is based upon specific work not being done on time, but being reported as being done on time. It doesn't make sense to say that that all work or some work or unidentified work isn't done on time, but reported on time. The scheme has to have specific tasks that were not done and were falsely reported as being done on a particular time.
So your point is that to satisfy 9B and Iqbal, the plaintiff here has to actually identify every instance of false completion times.
I wouldn't say every instance. I don't think the courts require that. But he has to identify at least some specific instances where the company did work after the time it was supposed to be done and falsely reported it as being done within the time, where that made a difference.
Yeah. Look, the purpose of this is to put your client on notice, right? And this complaint does that. I agree about 3, 4, and 5 don't, but this 1 and 2 tell you exactly what you need. I mean, count 2, you know, he says he personally witnessed. This is the one about minor repairs, right?
Right.
He says he personally witnessed Curther and Thayer's inflating the values of minor repairs. He talks about people who boasted about the about how they inflated the prices of it. He lists particular repairs. I mean, look at paragraph 94. He lists each one of these by date. June 20, replaced certain fan motors. July 22, 3 bathroom fan repairs. On or about this other date, emergency light repair. On or about this other date, more emergency light batteries. You know, I mean, it's pretty specific. True, it's not every one of them, but notice pleadings never require that.
Right. In count 2,
yeah,
the allegation is that the contract says that certain work cannot be compensated unless a form is filed with the government and the government approves it. Here, that form is the minor repair work order. Now, keeping in mind that the key to a False Claims Act case, as this court said in SAIC, is deceit. That's really the key to a False Claims Act case. So here we have a situation where certain repairs cannot be done unless a form is filed and the government approves. The form was filed. There is no allegation that the form is in any way incorrect or deceitful. And that's what the judge looked at. There was a clear disclosure to the government of the work to be done, why it was to be done, and there's no allegation of any deceit or falseness.
That could take you to a little greater level of generality. This is not just notice pleading that's required here. This is 9B pleading, which is by expressly an exception to the notice pleading standards of the rest of the civil rules. Thank you.
Right. And so we need that kind of specifics. We also don't have in count two or count one or even or the other three counts that don't seem to be concerning the court so much. We don't have in any of these counts the allegation of scienter, which, as this court in SAIC said, is a key issue to distinguish between a breach of contract and a false claim. And that requires strict enforcement. That's what this court said in SAIC. We don't have any allegation of any fact. We have allegations of conclusions. We don't have any allegation of any fact as to any of these five counts that any officer of any of the companies had any knowledge of any of this conduct. So even in counts one and two, if we assume that there are specifics in the allegation of the scheme, there's no specific as to any of the scienter. We also have to keep in mind that there are multiple defendants here, and it's not enough simply to lump all of them together, as was done in the paragraph that the court was looking at during the appellant's argument, where 10 or 15 names are listed. Here there are multiple defendants. The evidence as to PAE is different as to the others. CTSI and NATI have different contracts. Some of the defendants are mid-level management. Some are officers. It's not enough simply to allege an overall scheme, and this court has held this many times, as have others. It's not enough to allege an overall scheme and then assume that the allegations apply to every defendant. It has to be looked at specifically. Just to go to one of the appellant's main arguments and one that the court has addressed for a few minutes on and off, does the appellant, the relator, Mr. Bender, does he lack access to information? That also can't be looked at just in an overall global sense. Each count is lacking different things. Some lack scienter, some lack materiality, some lack falsity. The question really is, as to each of the missing pieces on each count, does the relator lack access?
And so your point about this is that the allegation in paragraph 50 is not sufficient because it's there, it's not in each count?
No.
Is that your point?
No. The allegation in paragraph 50 is insufficient because under Twombly and Iqbal, the only allegations that are entitled to a presumption of truth are allegations of fact. All that's alleged there is a conclusion. And in fact, to show how what a naked conclusion this is, throughout the complaint, the relator goes to some trouble to allege over and over again that he has personal information.
Let's stick with 50. He says, statements and documents submitted to the government lie within the possession of the two companies. That's his allegation. That's specific. He's a low-level electrician. That's totally plausible. Why isn't that enough?
Because
that kind of allegation was not present in Williams.
Right. That's because it's not enough for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
One is it's purely conclusory. Secondly, not every missing piece in every count is based on documents. For example, scienter, which is a problem in all five of the counts, doesn't require him to see any documents. Scienter would require him seeing, for example, is there an officer aware of anything? Is there an officer there? Does he talk? Has he ever told any of the officers? It's purely conclusory to say that the information's not available to him. Has he made any effort to get it? If any defendant, if any plaintiff,
he's not employed there.
Well, he was at the time. He was employed there.
He's a low-level electrician.
Right. Well, if any
You yourselves mentioned Iqbal. It's a question of plausibility. You think that it's implausible that a low-level electrician would not have access to these actual submissions to the government?
I don't believe that's the meaning of plausibility under Twombly. Plausibility under Twombly is, has he alleged a fact which, if found true, is sufficient upon which to base the complaint?
Yeah. The question here, though, is whether his allegations are sufficient to claim lack of access.
Right.
That's what you and I are talking about.
Now, if any plaintiff in any 9B case could simply say, I lack access, you've eviscerated 9B.
I agree with that.
Right.
That's a real problem.
Right. What you need is under these cases and under the Cole case, or Cowell, I guess it's pronounced, some basis to say not just that that some information somewhere is possessed by the other party, but does he really lack access to it? Has he made any effort to get it?
I agree. We're talking about the core of the issue now here. But this lack of access principle has to mean something. I mean, it's in our case law.
Right.
So here he said, he didn't just say some evidence exists somewhere. He said, what I don't have access to are, quote, statements and documents submitted to the government. That's what he said. Now, so my question is, and I take your point, this lack of access doctrine could eviscerate 912, which we can't let happen. But yet, the doctrine has to have content. It must mean something. And if a low-level employee who is can't take advantage of it with this kind of allegation, I'm not sure who can. I'm not sure what's left of it if it's not this person under this circumstance.
Your Honor, may I respond?
Sure.
My red light is.
No, please.
We're not nearly as strict on our times as the Supreme Court, for example. Go ahead.
I appreciate, Your Honor. I think that the first thing to look at here is you have to look on each count, what's the missing piece? And I don't think on any count is the sole missing piece the actual claim filed with the government. Scienter is missing in every count. Materiality is missing in a lot of the counts.
Suppose just for purposes of our discussion here, suppose the only thing missing was the actual submissions to the government. Do you think this would be enough?
No. I think he would be a step closer.
What wouldn't he have done?
Right. The requirement is not merely that the other party have the information. Uh-huh. The requirement is that the information must not be available to him. And I would say that requires, at a minimum, some indication of, has he made any effort to get the information? Uh-huh. If he were to come in and say, here's what I did to try to get the following documents and I couldn't get them, then I think he would have made an allegation that would be entitled to a presumption of truth. But simply to say, whatever I don't have, I can't get, is conclusory and is not sufficient. Especially in light
up now, unless my colleagues have further questions.
All right.
Being none, I will reassign 2 minutes back to the appellant for rebuttal if she wishes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to just address very briefly a couple of the things that were just raised. One, with respect to count four, Your Honor, I'd like to point out that even though in the allegations of the body of the complaint, it does not allege.
Can I ask you to spend your 2 minutes on counts one and two?
Yes, Your Honor, I will do that. With respect to count two, the appellee argues essentially that there is no allegation of scienter or deceit.
Right.
And we would submit that the entire allegation of the scheme's existence is to suggest that scienter element exists.
Where does it allege scienter?
It's incorporated in the actual count is where they focus on the scienter element, which is conclusory there, but when taken with the paragraphs that are then incorporated in that predate that, what those specific statements indicate under paragraph 94, for instance, five specific instances of the alleged falsification are identified. There are inferences identified, I believe, in paragraphs 88 and 89, wherein Roost and Carothers bragged about NATI's earning $1 million a year through the submission of these falsified work orders to the government. And it also identifies the February 1998 memorandum from Roost. Roost is the program manager, to Wang, which is the president, talking about pushing for more work orders of this nature. So, and I'll quote, to double dip the government and make extra money. So while that memo precedes the statute of limitations period, the allegation of the scheme is that that practice continued. It was started by NATI and continued through this close relationship of family members.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up again.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.